Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Best Bets Podcast. Once again, I'm joined by Sam Vecini from The Athletic and Reeves, who used to be from Barstool Sports, but who is now the 3-on-3 basketball maven. We will get into that a little bit later in the show.
I didn't get fired. I am still with Barstool Sports.
You are, but you are now the 3-on-3, the 3v3 basketball maven. And again, we are going to get into that. I'm going to explain what I mean by all of that. But before we do, we have some basketball to break down. As always, we're going to go through every single game that is going to happen in the Sweet 16. We're going to talk about it from a betting perspective, how we think it's going to play out, who we think is going to score a lot of points, why we think Mifiondo Kavengele should play more minutes than he actually does, things along those lines. So let me just start with this.
Say that name again.
Fiondo Kavengele. The M being silent always throws me off and will never not throw me off because M should never be silent.
Mifiondo. That was strong.
Mifiondo. All right. So Sam Riggs, what's going on, guys? How we doing?
Surviving, trying to survive until tomorrow, Thursday, whenever this comes out. We're recording on Wednesday, but it's weird, man. The stretch from like Selection Sunday to the first Thursday seems to go by so quick, but from round two to round the Sweet 16, it makes me miss watching something. Like I've just been wandering aimlessly and like randomly looking at houses for sale, and we're not moving.
Is that because your house just keeps falling apart?
Seriously, like, you should move.
I don't know. We're moving south at some point in the next like 5 years, and I guess I'm getting ahead of the trend already.
See what you gotta do. That is Riggs. You gotta fly from Cincinnati to Atlanta, like I did, flying from LA to Atlanta to go to McDonald's basketball practices and go watch high school kids. That's the way you get over the distance between basketball in these 3 days.
You want to know what tough. I tried to do? I tried to actually get some sleep, and it wasn't that successful. That's what happens when you have a 2-week-old child at home. So listen, guys, one thing that I would definitely recommend in your futures that you never do is have a child during March Madness. It was not the best planning and decision-making process on my end.
Yeah, mine's coming right as the season starts.
That's not a bad thing, though.
No, but I'm doing the opposite. I'm trying not to sleep just to get like mentally prepared.
Which, that's a little bit more doable because you don't have as much stuff to do during the day where you can kind of catch up and rest a little bit, and you don't have to be up early in the morning. And but when it comes to March and, you know, you just got to churn out content. Well, we know you don't churn out content, Sam. You don't write anymore. But for those of us that are still actually writers that are producing content for people to read.
How many words have you written over the course of the last week?
A million.
A lot.
Every single word in the human language I think I've written in the last.
I will say this. I just wrote like 6,000 yesterday and published it. And then I'm writing something probably for tomorrow, and I'll probably write something this weekend. So I'm there with you. Like I'm in this with you guys, just doing something different.
Congratulations. That was my Tuesday. all right, let's talk about the games. I don't know about you guys, but I actually had a nice little rally late on Sunday night with Houston and with Oregon to get me back into the positive numbers, up maybe like a unit and a half or 2 units, something like that. I can't remember how much I actually ended up investing, but I did get back into the black. Did you guys make it out all right from this weekend?
No, I had a very bad weekend.
Yeah, I'm not as bad as Riggs, but I'm probably down like 6 units.
I'm a little under 8, but I had a good Saturday. Thursday just destroyed me.
Thursday
killed me as well.
Thursday was not a good start to the tournament, but you know what? We made a comeback, and you know what else? We're about to make a comeback this weekend. So let's get started talking about these games. We're going to go in order, starting on Thursday night's first tip, ending with Friday night's last tip, which means the first game that we have to talk about is Gonzaga against Florida State. Gonzaga is favored by 7.5 points. The total is 146.5. Those numbers are coming from DraftKings Sportsbook, which is where we're going to get all of our odds from. Sam, let's start with you. What do you like there?
So I'll be at this game. I think it's hilarious that the first game starts at 4:09 Pacific time on the West Coast. Like, why is this the first game? Why couldn't they make this the later game? Gonzaga is, for me, one of the two or three best teams in the country. But I think this Florida State matchup is pretty interesting because they have the length, they have the athleticism. They aren't going to play anyone under 6'4 because Nichols is hurt right now. So they have the kind of size to match up with Gonzaga and I think really cause them problems. I don't think I'm going to go for like the full stop upset money line, but I do like Florida State with the 7.5 here.
Riggs, where do you fall?
Yeah, I agree that Gonzaga is one of the three best teams in the country, four best teams in the country, but I think Florida State's one of the 10 best teams in the country. So it's not like a huge drop-off in terms of talent or anything like that. Florida State just has so much depth and like Sam said, size to where, yeah, they can bother Gonzaga. I think the key, I don't think it's Gonzaga offense or Florida State defense. I think it's more, can Florida State score versus Gonzaga? Like, can Gonzaga rebound defensively? I think Florida State can get some free points on the offensive glass.
My big thing here is, and you know, I've been railing on this point all season long when it comes to Gonzaga, is Josh Perkins. And, you know,
you go way too hard on Perkins. Let me be clear.
All season, the last 3 years I knew you.
Yeah. But here's the thing about Perkins, right? He is the reason why Gonzaga's offense is as good as it is. Like, I don't want to take away from the season that he's had, but he's also proven throughout his career that he can have moments where it's a disaster. And I think the perfect example of that is the St. Mary's game in the WCC title game. I think that we saw it a little bit last year when these two teams played in the Sweet 16, when Florida State was a 9 seed, Gonzaga was a 4 seed, and Gonzaga ended up losing that game. I think they lost by 15, if I am remembering correctly. So my thing
got ugly late. Yeah,
it did. And so my thing is not that Josh Perkins is not good. My thing is that when Josh Perkins has his bad games, that can be disastrous for Gonzaga because he is the guy that is kind of the maestro that makes everything happen. And this matchup right here is the kind of matchup to me that is not good for him when it comes to getting big guy or big guard after big guard after big guard getting thrown at him with a team that does not mind pressing and playing in the full court. And I think this is a really, really bad matchup for them. Now, the one key, and maybe Sam, you can talk about this a little bit, is Killian Tilly is back. I'm not quite sure how healthy he is, but he's playing like 15 minutes a game since he's been back. So what is that impact that he will provide Gonzaga and what kind of difference will he make?
So if I remember correctly on this game last year, and I think I do, I'm not like 100% sure on it. If I remember correctly, Florida State started to press Gonzaga and started to cause some issues there. With Tilly, what he's able to do is kind of be the guy who breaks the press. He actually missed this game last year, if you remember.
He did.
I'm sorry, say that again?
He did. He was definitely not there.
Yeah. He was out for this game last year. What he does is he creates an ability to break the pressure because he's such a good ball handler and he makes great decisions. They can throw him the ball as a safety valve, kind of in the middle of the floor, basically anywhere on the court, and he's going to be able to make the right call and break the press. So I think that having him is a huge impact, even if he's only playing like, you know, 20 minutes, let's say. He played 18 in the first two games. So let's say they up that a little bit as he continues to feel a little bit better. He'd look great against Fairleigh Dickinson. So I think that he's actually a huge impact. And then look, they didn't have Brandon Clark last year either. And Brandon Clark is the kind of guy that is so athletic that he can actually match up with the matchup problem that is Fiondu Kabengele. With the way that Clark plays, it just kind of naturally draws fouls a lot of the time. And you can say the same for Rui Hachimura. If there's one thing that you can do with Fiondu Kabengele and, you know, honestly, kind of with Florida State generally, you can get them in foul trouble pretty easy, I think. And foul trouble for them is a little bit different just because they have so many bodies that they can throw at you. You know, they have the depth to withstand foul trouble. But I think that you're going to see a game here where Gonzaga kind of lives at the foul line.
Yeah, I don't.
One thing, though, with Kofor and Nichols potentially both not playing, there's two guys right away that you can't. I mean, their depth is still there, but now they're short.
Yeah, for sure.
And the issue with Kabengele, which I fully admit, is that when he does get in foul trouble, Florida State becomes a different team. It's very frustrating for me to watch the first 6 minutes of Florida State games that I may or may not have wagered on and see Chris Kumaji out there shooting 2-foot layups 5 feet away from the rim. I don't know if you guys saw that in the Murray State game, but he had some of the, I've never seen a guy that's 7'4" miss a layup as badly as Chris Kumaji missed a couple of those layups. So I do think you're right. Whether or not Kevin Gelly can stay on the floor will be a big key. I just expect him to be able to. I think that he is the guy that can kind of take away a little bit of what those other two guys that you mentioned do. Agreed. Well.
So the weird thing about Chris Kumaji, though, too, is if you look at Florida State's numbers, they're way better with him on the floor defensively. Like they are really considerably better. I think it's like by 8 points or something, and it's basically a direct correlation with Fiondu's numbers as well. I don't really know what to make of Kumaji's role in this game. Like, I think there's a real chance that Gonzaga just plays him off the floor by having Josh Perkins and Zach Norvell take ball screens and shoot whenever they play drop coverage with Kumaji. But I also wonder, like, this Gonzaga team doesn't have anyone who can match up with him size-wise. Like, there's a chance that, like, they can just run pick and rolls and run, like, little dump-off plays to Kumaji and get, like, you know, 8 or 10 points or get, you know, 6 points off a second chance on his, like, tip-outs and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
What do you think? I almost think Terrence Mann is the X factor for Florida State. Am I crazy for thinking that?
Why? Explain how.
His size at 6'7", he you know, we talked about everything like that, so he can match up with who do we think is the cross matchup for him? Is it Rui?
For Mann, I would bet that they throw Norvell on him.
Throw Norvell on him. So, I mean, listen, Norvell can get buckets, but can he get stops? And I think Mann's a guy that can take advantage of that.
I will say, like, you talk to WCC coaches, they don't think as poorly of Norvell defensively as what, like, maybe the national people do. They think he's actually okay on that end, but it's definitely something of a advantage for Mann.
He's been better. Like, everyone on that Gonzaga team has been better defensively as the season has gone along.
Yeah.
But Mann's also one of the guys who I think can – listen, Florida State's not a great three-point shooting team. Mann's a decent enough three-point shooter where you have to respect it. Does that open up enough? I mean, he's not going to go out and shoot 5 threes a game or anything like that, but if he hits, you know, 2, let's say, in the first 8 minutes of the game with that size that he has and ability to kind of he's going to have a couple inches on either – if it's Norvell, he'll have a couple inches on him. If it's Rui, he's probably quicker than him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it matters. I think that the game is going to be won, at least the way that I see it playing out, by how well Josh Perkins – handles Florida State's pressure and how well he handles the bodies that are going to be coming at him. Personally, I like Florida State to cover. I do have them advancing past Gonzaga in my bracket, but probably will not be on the money line in this game.
Yeah, I have them covering. I have them in my Calcutta pool, so I already have something invested on their money line. But I do think 7.5. When we saw that open, we started texting, and I was shocked it was that high right off the bat.
Yeah,
so I am too. Yeah, I'd say like 72-68 Gonzaga or something like that.
Yeah, so we're all on the same page, Florida State to cover.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. We have Purdue and we have Tennessee tipping off at 7:29 p.m. Eastern time in the Louisville South region. So Riggs, why don't you start us off with that one?
Ultimately, it comes down to, and this is how I feel about every Tennessee game: what Tennessee defense shows up. Because we've seen them look great at the end of the season against Kentucky and Mississippi State. We've seen them look flat out kind of terrible second half Colgate, second half Iowa.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you can even look at the just halves of their two NCAA tournament games.
Right. So which Tennessee shows up? Because, like, Purdue has Carson Edwards. We saw what happens when he gets going with the Villanova game. What, 42 in that game? Mm-hmm. So somebody's going to have to put a body on him and stop him. And, you know, to me, it just comes down to, simply put, can Tennessee get enough stops to, A, push the lead up so when they don't get stops, they are still comfortable to win, or can they just kind of control the game? And I don't think it's anything difficult to think except Tennessee's defense. And one thing I want to see is, I was talking about this with somebody today, we watched a clip of the Tennessee-Gonzaga game where Clark had that ridiculous block. And then he drew a foul on Grant Williams on the offensive possession where Williams kind of just put his chest into him and flopped back. Grant Williams should not be doing that 16 feet away because I think he's starting to fall in love with that a little bit more. Just don't pick up that cheap foul because I think that's going to be called more and more as the tournament goes on. So it's just Tennessee's defense. That's ultimately what it comes down to for me.
You want to hear a crazy stat about Carson Edwards? This actually blew my mind. So in Big Ten play, his usage rate was right around 35%, right? Which is among the 10 highest usage rates in all of college basketball. In Big Ten play, he shot 34% from the field. He shot 30% from the three-point line. And Purdue was still the second most efficient offense in the Big Ten and the fifth most efficient offense in all of college basketball, despite the fact that the guy that used 35% of their possessions was shooting 34% from the floor and 30% from three, which tells me, like, if Purdue gets good Carson Edwards showing up for this game, I just wonder, like, how is Tennessee going to stop that offense? Right. Because they're elite when Carson Edwards is not elite. And the one thing that, like, kind of stands out when you've looked at, like, the last four, five, six games that Tennessee has played is they've not been able to stop people on the perimeter. You know, in the SEC title game that they lost, I think Auburn was, what, like 15 for 40 from three or something like that? Bryce Brown and Jared Harper got it going in the last game of the regular season when Tennessee lost to Auburn. Colgate hit 15 threes. You know, I think that what happened with Iowa is Rick Barnes recognized that Iowa has a bunch of shooters, and he tried to let Tyler Cook get guarded one on Tyler Cook and Luka Garza get guarded one on one in the post. And the second half, that was a total disaster. So I think you're right. I'm very worried about how Tennessee is going to slow down Purdue's guards. And then Sam, on the other side, I'm also very worried about, like, what in the hell Purdue is going to do. Like, how does Purdue match up with Grant Williams? Who guards him?
Nojel Eastern, right? That's, like, kind of the easy answer.
I think so, but I don't think that Nojel Eastern is strong enough to be able to guard Grant Williams in the post. Like, Grant Williams is a strong, strong human being.
Who's guarding Schofield in this scenario, too?
Yeah. Maybe Grady Eifert. Yeah,
I
mean,
that's what I think you do. I think you cross-match Eifert and Eastern on Schofield and Williams. And I mean, like, honestly, Evan Boudreau might have to, like, play some real minutes here.
He is old man strength. He's no less than 42 years old.
Yeah, like, I'll be really interested to see, too, like, what is Travion Williams's role in this? Like, do you try and play him? They played him a lot during the middle of the season, and, you know, he hasn't really played much in the NCAA tournament so far.
I think you can probably play him against Kyle Alexander a little bit, no?
Well, I think that you're going to play Harms against Alexander because that's just the easiest way to go about it. But I do think that at some point they're going to need to get some real minutes just strength-wise from Travion Williams. Otherwise, it's going to be hard. But, you know, you guys hit the nail on the head here in terms of what the biggest, like, concern is. These two teams, they are so, like, awful, really, at defending the three-point line. They give up a ton of points from behind the arc. Like, Purdue, teams shoot 44% of their shots from three and shoot 34% on those shots. You know, if you isolate that to Big Ten play, they were 14th in the Big Ten in terms of the percentage of threes that they gave up. And then you go to Tennessee, I mean, it's not as bad, but it's pretty bad. They allowed 36% from three when 40% of the shots were from distance. Like, this is going to be a three-point fest, I think. These two teams are going to shoot from distance the whole game. And, like, I mean, like, I hate to make it simple. Like, it's obviously the team that makes shots is going to win. But, like, that's really what it comes down to in this game. Like, the team that makes more shots is going to win. Like, it's not – like, I think that both these teams are so strong in terms of the way that they execute offensively that – they're going to get open shots. It's just whether or not they fall.
See, I don't know if I agree that Tennessee is going to be a team that shoots a bunch of threes in this game, because I think what they'll do is they're going to run everything through Grant Williams. And whether or not they get those shots is going to come down to how Purdue ends up guarding it. Right. So let's say
Purdue can just crowd, though. That's what they're going to do. They're going to throw probably Nojel Eastern on Williams, but they'll crowd him constantly in the post.
Yes, and that could create a lot of looks. But the thing is, if they're making those threes, that's the kind of thing. I mean, this is just whatever, but that's the kind of thing where you could end up seeing Grant Williams just kind of isolated from 15 feet, which is where he's at his best. When you kind of put him in the mid post and just let him go, I think that is the ideal situation for him. But the thing about Tennessee's offense is, like, what they want are two pointers. Like, it's unbelievable to me that we've made this point a bunch, but they're number three in offensive efficiency, and they get 25% of their points from behind the 3-point line, which is 320th nationally. So they're not like one of these Daryl Morey 3-point revolution analytics whatevers. They are a team that, like, the reason that they are as good as they are is because they are unbelievably efficient at scoring from inside the arc.
Can we just bring up the coaching matchup too real quick? Matt Painter, never been beyond the Sweet 16. Rick Barnes, the last 10 years before this one, hasn't been out of the second round. I'll be real interested to see.
Rick Barnes won 9-1 against the spread in his last 10 tournament games too.
Yeah, I'll just be really interested to see how that matchup plays itself out. I love the over in this game. Personally, like, I think this is going to be a score fest. I really do. Like, I think that first to 80 wins.
Here's one thing defensively I'm curious about, and want to see if you guys think it's even possible if they'll do this. Could we see Purdue go kind of like UCF light versus Duke with Grant Williams and just not sag as much as UCF did, force Trey Jones to shoot those threes, but, you know, kind of sit, you know, put a guy at like the free throw line and dare him to shoot the threes, because he's not a great 3-point shooter.
Man, that's really hard, because you basically have to not guard someone to do that. And, like, look, shit, even Kyle Alexander can, like, kind of step out and shoot sometimes. Jordan Bowden's a 36% 3-point shooter. Jordan Bowen obviously is a 36% 3-point shooter. You can knock down shots. Lamonte Turner, like, I know the percentage isn't great, but I don't really have faith in just leaving him open.
The guy who's guarding Grant, instead of applying pressure, just literally sag and sit almost like a fort defense until he has the ball in that mid post.
They do that every once in a while. Like, one of the things that Tennessee is really, really good at is having the big guy at the rim seal off the shot. Like, for a team that doesn't shoot a lot of threes, one of the things they do to create space is the guy at the rim just seals off the shot blocker. And it's something that you see over and over and over again. And part of the way to defend that is whoever the trail big is, sag off him and have another body in the paint to help out. We saw that in the first game against Kentucky, and I think didn't Grant Williams hit three threes in that game? Something like that?
Yeah, he had a couple. He had two in the first half. I forget if he hit one in the second half. But, I still kind of roll the dice, and as weird as it sounds, lose by Grant Williams making outside shots.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way that you want
to. Well, he won't take them, though. That's the thing.
Yep.
Yeah, but if you're wide open for, you know, how many possessions in a row, your brain tells you to start shooting.
So, see, but like, his doesn't. That's the problem. Yeah. Like, it's what drives me nuts about him. Like, he can shoot the ball. He just chooses not to.
So here's what I think the take is, at least from a betting perspective. If you have a real feel on who you think is going to get hot, that's who you should bet on. But the best bet is probably the over in this situation. Do we all agree on that?
The best bet is let Tennessee get up big and then take a Purdue live line.
Yes, that was my move.
I like that too.
LSU in the LSU Maryland game. I bet the LSU first half, and then as soon as I got a live line for the second half, I bet Maryland there. And I also bet Maryland for the full game at +2.5, and they all covered. That was one of the proudest moments I've had in gambling history, and maybe we should do the same for Tennessee here.
What are the numbers on this game again, real quick?
It is Tennessee -1.5, and the total is 146.5.
Yeah, I'm with you on the over, and I do really like the matchup for Purdue, but I'll probably stay away and do what Reed said.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on. We have in the second game out west, where Samuel will be, we have Michigan -1.5 against Texas Tech, where the total is 126.5 in what may actually turn into a fist fight before the night is over. Sam, why don't we start with you on this one?
Under. Under. I don't see how these two teams get points on each other. I really don't. Texas Tech is going to be able to just throw constant bodies at the way Michigan runs their offense. They do such a good job of switching coverages defensively with screens. Like, they have no problem switching screens. They have no problem forcing guys, they'll force guys baseline into the help defensively. Like, they do so many different things depending on where the screen is set, and they're so defensively sound at doing it. Man, I just don't know how they score. And then you look at on the other side, I mean, Texas Tech, they just don't take a ton of threes. Sometimes they'll make shots, but you know, with a team that has the kind of athleticism that Michigan has on the perimeter with, you know, Xavier Simpson and Charles Matthews, and you can throw Isaiah Livers out there as well as someone who does a pretty good job guarding most of the time. Like, I just don't, they have bodies to throw at Jarrett Culver. Charles Matthews on Jarrett Culver is the matchup of the NCAA tournament this round that I am most excited to look at, because Matthews is one of the three or four best perimeter defenders on wings in the entire country. And if you can shut down Jarrett Culver, you can shut down Texas Tech's offense.
Riggs, where do you stand?
I am on Texas Tech money line. And that's just, I don't love it, but I like it. I think I'm more confident in Texas Tech's offense than I am Michigan's offense. And that's ultimately what it comes down to in this. I agree that, you know, unders should be the play here, but I trust that one of those guards, I think you're going to, obviously the Culver Matthews matchup, but Mooney and Moretti versus whoever Simpson isn't guarding has to get buckets, whether it's on driving kicks or whether it's on some sort of ball screen. One of those guys has to get buckets. I think I just kind of trust them more than someone from Michigan shooting.
Yeah, I would assume that that Simpson's going to be on Mooney, and
that's
that
my guess.
Poole will be on Moretti.
Moretti,
but
yeah.
We'll see how that ends up playing out. I think that I lean towards Texas Tech here as well, and there's two reasons for that. I think that Texas Tech will be able to go small and be able to match up at the four still with Michigan, in terms of, you know, putting like a Brandon Francis or Deshaun Kapru will be able to do what they need to do against Charles Matthews and Iggy Brazdeikis. So I think that Texas Tech is going to have a little bit of an advantage there. And I also think that when it comes down to it, like any game where you kind of have to say, okay, this game is going to get won with defense and this game is going to get won with toughness, as much as it pains me to bet against Xavier Simpson in that situation, I'm never going to bet against Texas Tech when it comes to playing a game that is going to get won with defense and toughness. I think that's the reason why I was so heavy on Texas Tech when they played Buffalo, and that's why I'm going to be on Texas Tech here, although I'm not quite as confident in this one as I was in the Texas Tech Buffalo game.
I have no confidence in betting either side of this game. My lean is personally Michigan, because I think that Matthews can really at least slow down Jarrett Culver in some regard. And again, like when you slow down Jarrett Culver, I find it hard to believe that Texas Tech is going to be able to find efficient buckets really from anywhere. So,
but do they have to be efficient in this game?
To an extent, yes, because look, like, we can shit on Michigan's offense like as much as we want. Like, they've been inconsistent, no question. But like, this is an offense that's still top 20 in the country with John Beilein running the show.
Sure. Like, yes, they keep climbing up too. Like, they were outside the top 30 for a while, and they keep inching up and up and up and up. And I, you know, honestly, we rag on Xavier Simpson for not being much of an offensive threat, but he has turned into a really, really good point guard in terms of like ball screen actions and being able to find John Teske on the roll, to find shooters that are popping out. And like, let's not forget that he has that like running sky hook, which we haven't really seen it as much recently, but that is definitely something where if you are going to play behind him on the screens, it's something where he's willing to turn a corner and go and take that running hook shot. He'll attack the big guy and go and take that running hook shot. And I think that is something that we might see Texas Tech try to do. But again, like, there's also, we saw what you can do if you switch. Michigan State exploited this. You saw what you could do defensively against Michigan when you switch. And I do think that Texas Tech certainly has the personnel to be able to switch everything, every one of those ball screens, 1-5.
The other interesting thing about this is all their weaknesses, or both teams' weaknesses, is like mirror of the other person. It's like Michigan, like on KenPom, Michigan's offense, like, they don't draw a ton of fouls. Texas Tech defense fouls a ton. Michigan does an offensive rebound. Texas Tech is actually a below average defensive rebounding team from a percentage standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, like, Michigan's offense doesn't turn the ball over. Texas Tech's defense turns you over. So it's going to be weird how like the strengths and weaknesses really mirror each other. And so there's, I don't, other games we've been able to like pinpoint the one thing, like, you know, whoever wins this has the leg up. I don't think we can really do that here either.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just, I think Sam is right. The place where you want to be in this game is on the under, just because it's going to be such a dogfight, and it's not, again, it's not a situation where I feel comfortable really betting either side of this line. I'll tell you what, though. As weird as it sounds, like, I am really, really excited for this game. It's not going to be
the West region.
For sure.
The whole West region is going to be awesome.
It's not going to be pretty in the same way that Auburn, North Carolina is going to be pretty. But I do think that this is the kind of game that will be a lot of fun to watch. I think it's almost assuredly going to be close. And I just kind of love those slugfests.
How low would this number have to be for you to bet the over?
118.
Samuel?
121, probably. Okay. Something like that. I think we're getting like 5 points here in terms of where
I would.
I was going to say 119 and a half.
I wouldn't.
If 120 is a win for the over, I'll probably take that.
I wouldn't bet the under if it's under about 124 or so, maybe 125, but I will not bet the over unless it's like under 120. I just do not see this game being reaching the 60s. Speaking of games that aren't going to reach the 60s, we have Oregon and we have Virginia. Virginia is favored by 8.5. The total in this game is 118.5. I think this is a sneaky tough spot for Virginia to be in, Riggs. What is your take on this?
I agree. It's going to come down to how does Virginia handle that like three-quarters court press into the matchup zone. I think they have the pieces to do it. Like if you like Hunter should be a good zone breaker there. I think Virginia has enough shooting. But again, limited possessions on both sides of the ball. Oregon, Kenny Wooten can really bother people at the rim. They have kind of those longer athletic wings. It's ultimately going to be, can Virginia get enough open shots? Like, I don't doubt that Virginia can hit shots, but can they get open shots?
Sam, where do you fall on this?
I think Virginia wins, maybe not comfortably. Like, I would still probably take the points. But I think it
like is Oklahoma game.
I think it's like a 7 or 8 point game. Yeah, like I do feel pretty good about Virginia because, look at... Oregon allows three-pointers on 45% of their opponent's attempts. That is 332nd in the country. And there's a huge disconnect in terms of the percentage versus the three-point attempts allowed. And like you can look at Oregon's, you know, three-point defense and say, hey, Oregon, like the reason that they are you know, they're willing to contest three-pointers instead of, you know, stopping them from happening at all. I look at this as almost purely like a Pac-12 deal where the Pac-12 is not like a particularly strong shooting league. And I think it's just holding that number down artificially. So I don't like the matchup of a team that is going to allow threes on half of their shots, essentially going up against a Virginia team that shoots 40% from three with like two flat out elite shooters. Like, whatever we want to talk about with Kyle Guy and Ty Jerome, they are unbelievable shooters. And DeAndre Hunter is a 45% three-point shooter. Like, they have guys that will knock down shots.
Don't forget Jay Huff. I think we see a lot of Jay Huff.
I think there's a real chance we see a lot of Jay Huff in this game, too.
I do. I was joking about don't forget him, but I do think we do see a lot of Jay Huff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's also – so with the point you made about three-pointers, Sam, is that – this is kind of a thing that's like a product of zones, right? Like one of the reasons that Syracuse gives up so many three-pointers attempted and they're always so good at defending the three-point line is that the way that they play is they want to force you into taking contested threes. And with their length and with their athleticism, they're really good at contesting those threes. And the other part of it is like when you're playing against the zone, it's difficult. Like the threes that you're taking are kind of off of swings and they're not quite in rhythm and they're not like driving kick and they're not offensive rebound kickouts as much. They're it's tougher to catch them to catch and shoot in a rhythm against the zone, especially when you have like
I will say I don't agree that they're not often offensive kickouts or offensive rebound kickouts.
There are some that are good. You're right, because it's easy to rebound against the zone. But a lot of the stuff that you get in like your actual offense is not quite as much of a rhythm three, and it's not going to be as comfortable as it would be when you're in a different situation. So I do think that that might play a little bit of a role. That said, do you guys remember what happened the last time that Syracuse and Virginia played? Syracuse shot 17 for 23 from three. in the Carrier Dome and ended up winning by like, I don't know what the final score was, but it felt like they won by 100.
Virginia shot 17.
Yes, I'm sorry. I don't know what I said, but yes, Virginia was 17 for 23 from three, and they won. It might have been by 100.
It was like a
279-3. Yeah.
Yes. So I think that we can run into a situation like that, which is why I think I kind of lean a little bit towards the over here.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah. Yep. I don't hate that play at all.
I don't know if I trust Oregon to be able to get enough stops. And I also think that if you look at the teams that have beaten Virginia this year, that they've had the most trouble defending, it is Duke times two, and it is Florida State. And the things that Duke and Florida State and Oregon all have in common is that they basically play three super athletic wings that can go out and get a bucket. And I think that Oregon kind of matches up that way. I'm not 100% like
Who are Oregon's three athletic wings that can go get a bucket?
Lewis King, Paul White, Ihabemidi. Like the
point Paul is, White's like a four though. Like he's not like he's a slow four than he's a super athletic wing. He can shoot.
Still a perimeter oriented kind of guy that can step out and make a shot. Like we're not talking about a team that plays two bigs.
I think the big thing that Florida State and the Duke and that these super athletic teams have is that they have a lot of big athletic wings that can get penetration and create driving kicks against the pack line. That I don't really look at Oregon as a team that does that because a lot of their penetration based offense revolves around Peyton Pritchard getting it. Cause like Louis King for all he is not like an unbelievable ball handler, Paul White, True. Not a ball handler.
That's fair.
Like, I don't really see this as like an advantageous matchup for Oregon offensively at all.
Well, nothing's going to be an I don't know if there is a single team that would be an advantageous matchup against Virginia. I just think that they have more of a makeup that's closer to the teams that have actually had success against Virginia than teams that have not had success against Virginia. And I think that's worth noting, especially considering the fact that Oregon, I think you made this point the other day, Sam, they've won 10 in a row and eight of those games have been on road or neutral courts.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they've been really, really good lately. Like Oregon is an awesome basketball team right now. What Dana Altman has done, Dana Altman, you've written about Dana Altman's problems in the past. I don't know that we need to rehash them, but for all that he is in terms of problems, he is an unbelievable basketball coach, and he's done an unbelievable job with this team.
I agree with all of that. So where do we stand? Are we all on the over? I think that
the over.
And then do you guys have any takes on the line?
What's it at right now?
I'm going Virginia. I'm at Virginia.
8.5 for you? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I think I would lean Virginia as well.
Yeah, if that gets under 8, I love Virginia. If it stays at 8.5, I would lean Virginia.
I believe, and don't hold me to this because I can't remember exactly, but I believe this opened at 8, so I think it is moving towards moving away from Virginia. So,
right.
Not necessarily ideal there. Let's move on though. The first game on Friday night is going to be LSU and Michigan State. Michigan State is actually favored by 6 points in this game. The total is 148.5. Sam, why don't you start us off on this?
I'm sorry, what game are we talking about?
LSU, Michigan State.
Very weird game in a lot of ways because my initial reaction was LSU money line. And then I remembered that LSU is kind of a disaster closing games and Michigan State is decidedly the opposite of that because of Cassius Winston being able to just slice and dice and pick and roll. Man, I think that I like LSU with the points because I think it's a close game, but I mean, this is a tough one. I think this is a tougher game than what I think this line is.
So this is where you have to trust things not on the court, and that's team of destiny, and that's what LSU is.
So here's where I think the LSU advantage is. LSU has Tremont Waters, who is going to slice and dice you in the pick and roll constantly. I think that's one thing that Michigan State can get hit with. LSU has bodies who they can pick and pop with. Naz Reid particularly stands out. But, if they want to throw, for instance, like a – Darius Days in there and toss him at the four for a minute. Like, they can cause some issues, I think, for Michigan State in space defensively, because, like, look, Nick Ward is a useful basketball player, but, you know, Tom Izzo will have to find a way to adjust in the same way that Maryland had to find a way to adjust to what LSU and Tremont Waters and their pick and roll based attack did. Now, if we're talking about adjustments, we're talking about Tony Benford versus Tom Izzo. And I know what side of the spectrum I tend to lean on, but the way that Maryland kind of adjusted to what Tremont and LSU presented them was they switched to a zone. And I don't know that I feel confident that Tom Izzo would be comfortable doing that.
Yeah, well, all that is fair. All that is fair, but I still kind of lean towards the side of this is the game where you want to take LSU's first half line, see what it is at halftime, and then take Michigan State's second half line. That's how I'm going to bet LSU for the rest of the tournament.
What would it be fair to say Michigan State has – we're just talking college players here, has the best player on the floor, but LSU is like 2 through 7.
It might be.
I would probably disagree with that, even
okay,
being like not a huge fan of Nick Ward.
Well, okay. I mean, this is coming from someone who is not a huge fan of Naz Reid.
Naz is fine. Like, Naz, I think, would probably be number 3 in this game. For me, like, he's really good. He's very, very talented. Honestly, Naz, I think, would be number 4. I think Skylar Mays is a better college player than he is
right now. Skylar's been terrific this year. He doesn't get nearly enough credit for the job that he's done.
He's been really good. So to me, ultimately, it comes down to, do you trust talent or do you trust coaching? Because that's ultimately what this game is, right?
That's why I'm saying you trust the talent in the first half, and then you trust the coaching in the second half that Tom Izzo will make some kind of a tweak. And honestly, like, when it comes to closing a game, I know what LSU's done, and I know the numbers. I know Tremont Waters has been great, all of that. But I just think that Cassius Winston is the kind of guy, in a close game, I want the ball in his hands. And I don't know if I would take Michigan -6, because that's a lot of points for a team as talented as LSU is. But I do think that Michigan ends up winning this game. I would not want LSU money line. But I do think that if forced to pick for something for the full game, I think I would probably take LSU.
I'm on LSU money line.
How many possessions of zone do you think Michigan State has played this year defensively?
I told you this the other day. I can't remember what I said. What was it?
5. How many do you think they played last year when they had like a team that, you know, realistically, Nick Ward, Jaren Jackson, like, they probably could have played zone and been pretty good. How many possessions do you think they played last year of zone?
9.
3.
How many do we think are on purpose? Because I'm guessing they probably accidentally ran.
I would bet that they're all like end of half or like late shot clock deals, basically. Just because, like, Tom Izzo, I bet, like, throws in, like, a random, like, hey, just pop in a 2-3 zone. There's 1 second left on the shot clock. Let's do it this way.
Are you worried about Michigan State's rebounding? Because that's where LSU kills teams.
No, I personally am not too much. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say that they're going to dominate LSU on the glass. But if there's one thing that Tom Izzo and Michigan State prioritizes, it's rebounding. And I do think that Xavier Tillman and, I know you guys don't like him, but Kenny Goins are big enough and tough enough that they will be able to be fine. Like, LSU is going to get theirs because that's just what they do. But I don't think this is going to be a kind of situation where, like, we look up and LSU has 30 second chance points.
Okay. Well, here's the other thing too. Like, LSU kills teams on the offensive glass, but they get hit hard on the defensive glass.
Yeah, it's because they just get lost trying to block every shot possible.
Right. So, like, I actually think Michigan State can probably come close to keeping pace there.
Yeah. So are we all on LSU at least +6?
I'm on LSU with the points and money line.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on.
Not money line for me, but +6.
Yes. Same thing with me. I would take +6. I don't think that LSU wins. Auburn, North Carolina. North Carolina is favored by 5. The total is, it opened at 160. It is up to 163.5. Riggs, where do you fall in this game?
I can't wait for this game. Like, it's going to be so much fun. But I am a little bit concerned with Auburn, where is this one of those cases where they're similar teams, but UNC is just a little bit better than them? Like, they just do everything a little bit better than Auburn does?
Yeah, I think that that's, I mean, as the saying goes, you can't beat North Carolina at what North Carolina does best. So now, I think that's definitely Auburn a concern.
I don't want to say Auburn has no chance, but, you know, Coby White versus Jarrett Harper is going to be phenomenal. But I don't know how Auburn matches up with Cam Johnson.
Yeah, that's going
to Chuma Okeke. That's an easy answer, isn't it?
No, they wouldn't. I don't think they would play Okeke. I think they would probably put
Macklemore.
Well, I would.
No, I think that you play. I think that what you do is you start three bigs against North Carolina. Like you start Okeke, Macklemore, and Spencer, or Wiley in that case, if you want to do that. Or you play Malik Dunbar or whatever.
Well, Dunbar has been starting for like the last four or five games at the very least. But I think that's actually the wrong tactic to take, because I think what you do is you take advantage of the fact that you have these smaller guys that Garrison Brooks and Luke May are going to have to chase around on the perimeter, and you just kind of hope that you're able to do a good enough job on Garrison Brooks and Luke May on the glass. Like, look, we're not talking about Tyler Hansbrough here. It's Garrison Brooks and Luke May. You should be able to do a job on them on the defensive glass. So I would say start the perimeter players or the perimeter oriented bigs and figure it out from there.
Here's a good thing too. Like Cam Johnson, for being 6'9", if you get a guy who can like really pressure him and get into his body, that's how you defend him. You don't do it with a big.
Yeah, you got to chase him around to make sure he's never comfortable on the catch. Yeah. So he's not someone putting the ball on the floor and getting by you. He's catching and killing you because he doesn't have a hand in his face when he is left open. Can I give you guys a hot take, though?
Go.
I love the under in this game. I'm going to let it keep climbing as high as it can get because I have a feeling that Auburn is not going to try to run with North Carolina.
Do they try to do what they did against Duke and Maui?
Yes, that's what I think.
Not that far of a degree, but that's concept.
Yes, I think that's what's going to end up happening. I think that this ends up being a slower game than anybody expects it to be, because I think that Auburn is going to try to take it, take the foot off the gas a little bit and turn this into a little bit of a half court battle. I don't think that they want to run with North Carolina. I think they're going to do what they tried to do against Duke. And so
thing is that Auburn hasn't run like crazy this year. Like that's like, it's kind of a misnomer for them.
It's a lot
like,
of secondary look at their stuff.
Yeah, you look at their average possession length this year, it's 16 and a half seconds, 64th in the country. Average tempo, because they tend to take longer defensive possessions, is like 157th in the country. Florida, you know, they played a 57 possession game against Florida in the SEC tournament. Like they're not afraid to play slow at all. I agree with you, Rob. I think the under is the play here.
Yeah, and here's the thing about it. Like they want to get out and run, and they want to get those quick-hitting threes in transition, and that is the first thing that they are looking for, right? They want to they want to turn you over, and they want to get a quick three within the first 7 seconds. They want to grab a defensive rebound, get the ball out in transition, and go. But if they don't get that first look, they're not just going to fire something up because they're going to try to fire something up. They'll pull it out, and they'll put the ball in Jarrett Harper's hands, and they'll run something. And I think that we're going to see that against North Carolina, where they'll be a little bit more diligent on the defensive glass. Like, they're not going to be leaking as many people out. They want to make sure that they get that done, because that is one thing that Roy Williams does prioritize, is getting to the offensive glass. So I think that they're going to keep a little bit more people in to protect against second chance points, which eliminate some of those quick hitting points in transition. And then I think that they are going to be more focused on making sure that they're not making the dumb mistakes or missing the long threes that will let North Carolina get out and kill you on the break. So I definitely think the under is a play here.
So can I just bring up one thing as well here? The key thing for me is how Coby White handles pressure, because we've seen games this season, for instance, Kentucky, my cat is on my laptop right now, literally writhing around trying to get me to like pat her. What a mess. The games where Coby White this year has struggled are the games where teams can kind of get into him and pressure him. Like the Duke game, for instance, with Trey Jones getting into him and pressuring him. If I remember correctly, Louisville tossed Quan Four on him and forced him into four turnovers. Ashton Hagans, like I said in the Kentucky game, had that game with where he had like 8 steals or whatever. How Coby White deals with the team in college basketball this season that has forced turnovers on a higher percentage of their possessions than any other team in college basketball is going to be where this game is won. If Coby White can handle the pressure and can run and create easy buckets and have 3 or fewer turnovers, North Carolina wins this game, I think, maybe by like 10 points. If Coby White struggles with the pressure, which I think is a real possibility, even though I'm a huge Coby White fan, I think Auburn like has a real chance to win this game.
Yeah, I think one key is also going to be Nazir Little, because he is the guy that he can get to the glass, and he's a guy that kind of thrives in these environments where games are a little bit more spaced out and a little bit more hectic and a little bit more up and down. And while I just said that I don't expect Auburn to run all that much, I do still expect there to be situations where they are getting out and running and getting out in transition. And more than anything, Nazir Little is the guy that has the size and athleticism and versatility to be able to match up with Okiki and McLemore a little bit better than someone like a Garrison Brooks. So I think that he's going to come in. I expect him to play like 25 minutes. And, you know, I would not be surprised to see him get like 15-8 or something like that. And if he can get there, then I think we're talking about North Carolina with winning.
See, I'm terrified of having Nazir Little play in this game if I'm North Carolina. Because if there's one thing that Nazir Little does a little bit too frequently, it's give up threes on offense or to the opposing, or give up threes on defense to the opposing offense. Like, he loses his guy pretty regularly whenever he's trying to guard off the ball. In a team in Auburn that can really take advantage of that, that worries me a little bit. I agree with you athletically. He's the kind of guy that can match up, but I don't know, man. That seems like a recipe that could end kind of poorly to me.
Fair enough. Riggs, you got any other takes?
No, I agree. I think Thunder's the play. I'm interested to see the cross matches, like everything we just said of who guards who and everything like that. That's half the battle in this single play. So I agree. Unders to play.
If you had to make a pick on the line, who would it be?
What's it at for you?
-5, North Carolina.
Probably UNC. I'm a little worried if Auburn's just starting to get tired at this point, too.
Yeah, I would probably lean towards UNC, and I would feel far more comfortable about it than I would betting on Auburn.
I don't love this game. I will probably just take the under.
Yeah, I don't think
I really think there is a chance that like Auburn gets into Coby White and causes issues.
Yeah, and there's also a chance that Bryce Brown hits like 11 threes. Like that's the thing about Auburn is that it's kind of like Sam. We made this point earlier in the year, right? It's kind of like betting on Marquette. Because
it is.
You don't really know. Like, there's going to be nights where Marcus Howard goes for 45, and there's going to be nights where he goes 2 for 19. And I don't feel comfortable being able to predict when those things are going to happen, unless, of course, St. John's is the team that they are playing.
I almost don't want to bet this game this way. I can just cheer for anarchy because I want to see 200 points, and I don't want to lose money on not having that.
Fair enough. All right, let's move on to the second game in Washington, D.C. It's going to be Duke -7 against Virginia Tech. That total is 144.5. This line actually opened up at 8.5, Sam, and it's down to 7 now. What are your initial takes on Duke and Virginia Tech?
A part of me just wants to say Duke is going to come out super pissed off that they lost to Virginia Tech last time they played. Zion will be there this time, creating a totally different atmosphere, and they're just going to beat the doors off of Virginia Tech. Like, I think there's a real chance that happens. The problem is that the way teams have tended to beat Virginia Tech this year is that you can kind of shoot threes against them. That's like kind of a sneaky deal where like even Florida State in the ACC tournament hit, I want to say, 12 threes against them. And they hit 10 threes in the loss in the regular season. And then, you know, Virginia knocked down 11 threes against them in their loss. And then, you know, you can keep going back. Louisville knocked down 13 threes against Virginia Tech in that loss. Like, that's how you beat Virginia Tech. You knock down shots that they leave you open for from beyond the arc. Over 50% of opponents' shots this year against Virginia Tech have come from beyond the three-point line. That's second to worst in college basketball. I just don't know if Duke can take advantage of that. And that's where the worry comes into play for me.
I do wonder, because Virginia Tech wants to kind of like press and jump you a little bit and then sag. I almost wonder if Duke can beat it quick enough to where they don't have to settle and Zion can attack.
That's a good call.
That's where I think I'm more interested in where I think the game goes than whether or not Duke can hit threes. Because that's always the question with Duke. Can they hit threes? To me, it's can they get Zion the ball quick enough to where Virginia Tech's still scrambling and not set up in that sag defense.
See, all of that stuff makes sense to me. But I personally am more worried about what Virginia Tech is going to do offensively. And actually, I guess it's a better phrase is what Duke is going to do defensively. The first time that these two teams played, one, Justin Robinson wasn't there, who is probably the best ball screen point guard that Virginia Tech has. And his presence on the floor means that Nikhil Alexander-Walker moves to a better position for him as the secondary ball handler playing off the ball a little bit. So you have two guys that are NBA caliber lead guards running ball screen actions that both of them shoot 40% from three, with two more guys on the floor spreading the court that both shoot 40-something percent from three. Like, Virginia Tech can really, 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 really shoot. And what they did was they just put Kerry Blackshear, their big guy, in ball screen actions over and over and over again. And if it was Javon Delore that was on him, then they just rolled him to the rim and buried him in the post. And if it was Marquise Bolden on him, then they would run these pick and pop actions, and they would just kind of force Marquise Bolden to try to guard Kerry Blackshear in space with four shooters around the perimeter, and that didn't work out well for anybody on Duke. So what I want to see is whether or not Coach K is willing to play Zion at the five, because to me that's how you fix this. That's how you solve this problem. Because Zion,
they did it a little bit against UCF for what it's worth.
Yes, and they, like, when they've run into situations where they need to make a comeback, that Zion was at the five the entire time against Louisville when they made that run.
Whoa!
What?
Alabama just hired Nate Oates.
Done.
Whoa!
How about that?
Wow!
That was a quick higher.
Oh, wow. I'm like thrown. That's not where I expected Oates to go.
That's not where I expected Oates to go either.
I was a little nervous when you said, well, because I have golf on and Tiger was shooting. I thought he just like drilled something. You scared me like that.
Anyways.
Zion, Alabama. That's a great hire.
That is a great hire. And I wonder if they're going to get Kyra Lewis and John Petty back with him there. Zion at the five. I think Zion, long story short, I think Zion needs to be at the five while for Virginia Tech to be slowed down the best they can defensively. I'm thrown off now. Nate Oates got me tripped up.
That came out of nowhere, too.
Yes.
I had not heard anything about that.
Well, every person, everything that you read about who was tied to the job or who were names rooming around there, I don't remember seeing Nate Oates once.
No, it was people thought they were going to take a swing at Chris Beard. Kelvin Sampson's name was brought up, and that probably went away as soon as Arkansas opened up. But I think Alabama did right by getting this done quickly, because with all the other jobs in the SEC that are open, you wanted to make sure that you got the guy you wanted. But back to Virginia Tech and Duke. Like, where we stand in terms of the 7 points in this one?
I think I'd take Duke. I think it's a mental thing, like you said. They got their scare. I think it's now go out, kick ass, and then maybe a scare in the Elite Eight again.
Yeah. I was on UCF to cover. I'm not going to be on Virginia Tech to cover in this one. I do think that Duke is going to find a way to get it done, and I think that eventually Coach K is going to go to Zion at the five, and when he goes to Zion at the five, I think that's when we see that patented Duke second half run. Sam?
Yeah, I'm with you, Duke.
All right, let's move on. Last game we got, it's kind of hard to dive into too much since we don't know whether or not PJ Washington is going to play and how healthy he's going to be. For what it's worth, he did tweet out a video today of himself walking down a hallway without a cast on his foot. So I'm assuming that he is going to suit up. I don't know if we're going to see good PJ Washington, if we're going to see him for like 10 to 12 minutes, what it's going to end up being. But the line as it stands is Kentucky -3, and the total is 134.5. Riggs, Kentucky's your team. Kick us off.
Yeah, so it's kind of mentioned it with Killian Tilly, and I think it's kind of the same approach here with P.J. Washington. If you can get 15 to 20 minutes of P.J. Washington, that's a huge, huge win for Kentucky, because what Houston wants to do, and they showed this against Ohio State, they double the big with another big. So they did it to Wesson, where they sent another big. If they can have Washington there, Washington's just such a good passer out of the post, and more importantly, he stretches the floor. So where is that? If Washington's guy is going to go double Travis, where is that coming from? Because that just leaves open another shooter. And I know people, you know, with Kentucky never think of shooting, but this is actually an okay 3-point shooting team. Again, 15 to 20 minutes of that, where, you know, it's one thing if you're doubling Travis and Washington. It's another thing if you're doubling Richards, Montgomery with Travis out there and not Washington. So it all comes down to that. 15 to 20 minutes, I think Kentucky wins if you have Washington for that. Without him, I do like Houston.
Sam?
So I agree with you, Rob, that it's really difficult to know what to make of this without knowing what's going to happen with PJ Washington. Kentucky's best source of offense lately has been Tyler Hero, I would say. If you watched Corey Davis in Houston go up against Utah State earlier this year, Utah State has Sam Merrill. Sam Merrill was the Mountain West Player of the Year, kind of weirdly, but he's really good. What he does is constantly run off screens, constantly try and, you know, knock down shots off the catch, off of, you know, down screens and pin downs, etc. Corey Davis for Houston is unbelievable at, like, locking and trailing guys like Tyler Hero, like Sam Merrill. These guys who can really, really get separation coming around screens. So I look at that as a really, really interesting kind of matchup to see how Kentucky is going to be able to create offense if PJ Washington doesn't play.
I think we kind of saw that against Wofford, though, where Hero was struggling offensively because he was just working his ass off defensively. They started just running that ball screen and letting Hagans attack.
I don't feel great about that, to be honest.
That's ultimately the thing. That's the next thing I was going to bring up is what Hagans shows up, because there are times where Hagans looks the part and he's really good at finding the roller in that ball screen. And if he can make layups, then it's a completely different Ashton Hagans. So I think if you see that happen, it then falls on Ashton Hagans more than anyone else.
I agree with all of that, to be honest. Here's my thing. I'm probably going to end up betting this game because it's the last game of Friday night, and, like, why not? But I don't feel I have no take either way because of all the things.
I have no take on anything in this game, like total, you know, team totals, the line. I can't give you anything on this.
Yes. So let me put this hypothetical out there. If we get word before the game starts that PJ Washington is 100% and, like, it's like we can trust it, whatever. Are you willing to take Kentucky -3 against this Houston team, considering that it is only 3 points and it is Kentucky and PJ Washington is healthy?
If they say Washington's 100%, or even if Washington, like I said, if Washington plays 20 minutes, I would probably lean Kentucky up to 3, 3.5, I guess, technically. Sam? Anything else, I'd lean Houston.
Sam?
I would probably lean Kentucky if PJ plays. Houston has beaten really good teams this year. They're athletic. Like, they beat LSU. They beat Oregon, who's also in the Sweet 16. That was an Oregon team, if I remember correctly, that had Bol Bol at the time.
Sam, I don't know how to tell you this, but Oregon, like I predicted, I'm patting myself on the back as we're doing this right now. As I predicted, Oregon is a better basketball team without Bol Bol. I don't get a lot of things right. I got that one right.
Oregon didn't have Louis King. I agreed with you on that.
I'm very strongly with you on that.
Sam, I don't get a lot of things right. Let me have my victory lap.
I'm with you. That was a good call. Anyone who watched Oregon early this year, Bol.
we don't need to bury Bol Bol anymore. I think Michael Avenetti has done plenty of that. All right, so
but
I think
don't want to be the NBA executive that has to go to my owner and say, "Hey, let's draft Bol Bol."
me either. All right, before we get out of here, Reeks, you are the 3-versus-3 Maven. Tell me what that is all about, please.
Yeah, so it's a really cool thing. It's the second year that it's been going on at the Final Four this year. It's at Mall of America. So, you know, it's a kind of a cool setting there. Each conference is represented. So 32 teams, 4 seniors that have exhausted eligibility because they're playing for money. You know, so You can go see your favorite guys one more time, or you can watch it. It's all on Twitter that you can actually watch it live as it happens. It's like 10-minute game, so it's perfect for a quick hop on your phone if you're trying to kill time or your computer. It's just really cool. So last year, the Big Ten won it. They had Vincent Edwards, Rob Johnson, Nate Mason, and Jayshon Tate. So it's, again, it's kind of cool because you saw the guys, you know, they played against each other for 4 years. It's kind of interesting to see them now play with each other. You guys were on the committee with me to kind of help select these teams. And again, I think now more than ever, people are talking about college kids making money. This is a chance for them to win money because you win money for each pool win. And then, you know, a big prize at the end if you win it all.
Sam, I appreciate the time. Riggs, I appreciate the time. Hopefully you guys have a better weekend this weekend than you did last weekend.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
See you guys.
That wasn't awkward at all.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.